Let's start in Sydney, where for the first time, Australia is hosting a summit of our northern neighbours, the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations. It is a diplomatic coup, given that Australia is not a full member of the ASEAN club. The meetings began this morning and will last until Sunday, against a backdrop of venues around Sydney Harbour. Human rights, political freedoms, and a pointed reminder to China about freedom of navigation in the contested South China Sea are all part of the agenda, formally and informally. I spoke a little earlier to our reporter Peter Lloyd, who is in central Sydney. Peter, before we get to the meetings with the ASEAN leaders, there are protests expected where you are in central Sydney. Who's in the firing line?
Well, at the moment, it's Cambodians living in Australia. They're gathering in Hyde Park in the centre of Sydney to protest at the Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, who 2 weeks ago made a typically menacing remark about beating up protesters if they confronted him in Sydney. Now, he's thought to be at a meeting of supporters at a hotel just across from where I'm standing. There's a large police contingent, like a police corridor outside the hotel. Today also saw a human rights protest. This one was against the civilian leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, over the questionable acts, the genocide, according to the UN, of Muslim Rohingyas in that country from back in August and September last year. Both of those things, Linda, I think they point to the political downside of Australia's ambitions for closer ties with ASEAN. It's a 10-member grouping with a very mixed record on human rights and civil society freedoms.
Yes, not to mention Rodrigo Duterte from the Philippines, who's not even coming. So, you know, that's another interesting element too. What, just on this summit, I mean, Australia is not a member of ASEAN, so why are we hosting this summit?
Yes, it seems a contradictory. It's a 10-plus-1 summit. It's ASEAN's memberships in a bilateral, essentially, with Australia. They've done this before with big powers like the United States, the Chinese, the Indians and the Japanese, and to some extent, Australia being a middle power, this is something of a political and diplomatic coup, both for foreign affairs and for the Prime Minister to be even staging this, which is an informal setting in Sydney against the harbour side, but it's very much a normal gathering of the ASEAN 10 and will have all the power and compelling force of all of their communiques.
And one headline today was a report in the Fairfax Press suggesting that Indonesia was inviting Australia to join ASEAN, but that's perhaps a misreading of actual intentions, isn't it?
Look, it could be. President Jokowi is nothing else. He's culturally Javanese and incredibly polite. He wouldn't want to be providing an impolite answer when asked a direct question, particularly one about whether or not Indonesia would support Australia's membership of ASEAN. And the other point to remember here is that Jokowi, he's not pretty much focused on foreign policy as a president. He's very much a domestic president, and he regularly gives responses that seem positive but are in fact non-committal in Indonesian terms. The other thing to remember, of course, is that ASEAN is a consensus-based organisation. No one single member gets out in front of the others, so no one's going to explicitly say it. But this is, in effect, very much a Southeast Asian club. It really says so in the charter of the organisation. And, for example, Singapore had objections to the idea of East Timor joining a couple of years ago. It's hard enough for the group to manage the consensus process amongst 10 members. So the idea of joining it to 11 or even 12 is simply beyond the politically palatable for most of them.
And, of course, playing into that is the shifting alliances within ASEAN itself, and that goes to the question of the elephant in the room, which is another non-member state, that's China. Will the ASEAN states deal with Beijing's ambitions for, particularly for greater control over the South China Sea at this summit?
Yeah, well, there's been indications today from what the Foreign Minister and both the Prime Minister have said at some of the press conferences and the media briefings. Essentially, Australia is trying to get language into the final communique that talks about the rule of law and the freedom of navigation in the seas. And that's an indirect reference to China's ambitions for what it wants to do in the South China Sea, which is basically take up land and claim the territorial sovereignty, which China says has been its ever since it was an empire. And on that topic, the US Navy's top admiral in the region and the man nominated to be Washington's next ambassador to Australia, Harry Harris, says that China is establishing military bases on 7 of the 14 islands that it's occupied, and that includes supporting troop barracks, aircraft and ammunition bunkers, and 10,000-foot runways.
He is the subject matter specialist on the military flashpoint that is the South China Sea and Donald Trump's pick for ambassador to Australia. So Admiral Harry Harris and his hawkish assessment of Beijing's island-building project is important listening.
While some view China's actions in the East and South China Seas as opportunistic, I do not. I view them as coordinated, methodical, and strategic, using their military and economic power to erode their free and open international order.
The stakes in this power play are huge. An estimated 11 billion barrels of oil and 190 trillion cubic feet of natural gas lie beneath the South China Sea. Ships carrying more than $3 trillion in trade pass through the region every year. The Spratlys and Paracel Island chain sit in the South China Sea. And it's on the atolls and reefs of both chains that China is quite literally changing geography. So far, 14 island bases, 7 now militarized, according to U.S. Admiral Harry Harris.
China's impressive military buildup could soon challenge the United States across almost every domain.
But it's not happening without pushback. The Philippines claims the Spratlys belong to it. In some places, Manila has countered the Chinese push south by installing troops on board a shipwreck deliberately grounded on a reef. In another, Filipino civilians are paid a salary to occupy tiny Pagasa Island in the name of the Philippine people. Their leader, Mary Joy, told a BBC documentary team their mission is simply being there.
It's very, very important that we have a school and people there because China may be thinking we can go or not, like that.
That's a view that holds true hundreds of kilometres to the east of Manila, the Philippines' capital. Charles Jose from the Foreign Affairs Ministry told the BBC crew how frustrated his country has become at Beijing's island building.
It is outrageous. It is expensive, like I said, excessive and without basis under international law. Well, they're doing it because they can.
And they do think they're right. China says its claim dates back centuries to when the Paracel and Spratly island chains were seen as part of the Chinese Empire. More recently, China has laid out a claim in a so-called nine-dash line that identifies almost the entirety of the South China Sea as Beijing's. Vietnam insists both island chains belong to it, and Malaysia and Brunei, to a lesser extent, say they own some of this terrain. The competing claims explain why ASEAN summits over the years failed to find a unified voice on the South China Sea question, and that division has been exploited by China. Aaron Connolly is an ASEAN watcher at the Lowy Institute.
Several of the weaker states, Cambodia, Laos, and Brunei, have really become co-opted by Beijing on this question. So there's been very little that ASEAN has been able to do about the South China Sea. We'll have to see what they come up with in the Sydney Declaration and the statement that they're crafting, which will be a joint statement between Australia and all 10 countries. But because several of the countries are increasingly Chinese clients, it's going to be difficult for them to actually put forward any kind of language that would be that would move the issue forward.
Aaron Connolly, he's a keen observer of Southeast Asia's nuances. He's with the Lowy Institute. Peter Lloyd, our reporter.